4 in Hyannis.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the year draws to a close and you dot the I's and cross the T's on another chapter of your life and of your world, we're taking a look back at the world of fiction 2002 tonight. Headlines deliver the news, but in a good year, it is often fiction that delivers the resonance and meaning that we crave. This was a volatile year for fiction. A startling number of rookie authors broke onto the bestseller lists with some of the best debut books seen in years. And yet, the New York Times Book Review claimed it could only find 7 noteworthy novels for its Editor's Choice list this year. Jan Martel was hit with controversy after he won the Booker Prize for his tale of a boy, a Bengal tiger, and a lifeboat. Donna Tartt was back after 10 years with a wise girl detective in Mississippi. Arthur Phillips took us to postmodern expat dreamland of young Americans in Prague. We're in the studio with bibliophiles tonight, scouring the shelves and your recommendations for the best fiction of 2002. What did you read this year and love? What is new fiction telling us about this crazy old world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Carol Horn, Vice President and Senior Buyer at the Harvard Bookstore, an independent bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I might add, winner of Publishers Weekly 2002 Bookseller of the Year Award. Good evening and welcome, Carol Horn.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. And Ron Charles is with us as well. He's book editor at the Christian Science Monitor. Good evening and welcome, Ron Charles.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Carol Horn, we're going to talk about books and authors and what's hot and what's not and what's great, but we want to get right in the spirit of this. Take us in. Just give us the briefest introduction to what you're going to read and then let us hear it.
Okay, I'm going to start by reading from a first novel by Brad Watson called The Heaven of Mercury. It was nominated for the National Book Award. And it's set in the Deep South, set in Mississippi, and it's 80 years in the life of a small town there, centered primarily around the friendship between two people, Finus Bates, who owns the newspaper and the radio station, and the woman he's loved unrequitedly for at least a good part of those 80 years, Bertie Wells.
Great.
And this is when he first sees her and they fall in love. Late morning, second day of a July Methodist youth retreat to a wide and lazy stretch of the Chunky River, 1917. Young Finus Bates felt the effects of a little shine he and the other boys had sneaked off to consume the evening before. He rushed from the campsite down a trail and slipped inside the thick-leaved cover of a button bush beside a tiny clearing. Hadn't been there long, voided but still too shaky to leave, when he heard voices come along the path, and through the slivers of space between the whorled, elliptical button bush leaves, he saw two girls, Avis Cross-Weatherly and Bertie Wells. Finus went absolutely still. Bertie was soaking wet because, he would find out later, she'd slipped on the bank and fallen into the river fully clothed. Avis looked up into the air, then all around. Finus squatted under the dense low cover of the shrub, pants around his ankles, ass cooling in a low breeze. Avis straightened and said, "My Lord, what is that smell?" "Something died," Bertie said. Finus quietly began to scoop sandy soil and dead leaves between his legs over his sick scat. But just after she's made her comment, Bertie had peeled off the last of her wet undergarments and stood naked and pearly white in the light threaded shade from the taller trees. And this is what Finus looked up again to see. She had that shape and look all around of the actresses and models of the day, just fleshy enough to make a man think of reproduction. And that which had seemed merely ordinary inside her clothing now took on a baroque sensuality. Finus could not have imagined in the abstract, much less in the reality of chattery Bertie Wells. Ample in the hip, yet augmented in protruding carnality of bone, pelvic jut like a smooth white plow, a sweet little benevoled pooch, and shoulder blades beautifully awkward as the small, futile wings of a hatchling. He gazed through the leaf lattice at the immaculate cradle shading of her visible ribs, smooth and defined of faint bone shadow, and the delicate scoop from which her long, slim neck rove into an oval face made beautiful in this light, an unself-conscious nakedness. A plum-shaped mouth, her sad and impish pale blue eyes. Not the face of a girl given to governing herself without considerable chaperonage and wackety discipline across the open palms. At least that was the way Finus imagined it. Her dark brown hair curled around her ears in a bob, fleeting red hues in the slim rays of sun that slipped in and fell upon it. Compared to Avis Cross-Weatherly's hard angularity, Bertie seemed like a regressive dream. Finus felt himself go curved and firmed as a summer squash. He watched, his heart heavy with the grief of longing, as Avis approached Bertie with a white bath towel. But something struck Bertie at that moment. She turned away from Avis and did a naked cartwheel, her legs and low, scanty pubis flickering through the dappled light, the motion quick and graceful as a child's. The child she was in ways he would never see again, and she landed upright with a look of surprise and conquest on her face, little breasts a-quiver. Upon landing, she gave a little yelp of surprise and then laughed out loud, spreading her arms for imaginary applause. They were giggling. Some sound almost escaped him, some inarticulate, expressive, muffled carp, and he closed his eyes then and thought he'd actually made no sound, but maybe he had, since before he could detect her approach, the leaves of his hideaway rustled, and he opened his eyes to see a pair of hands parting the branches. It was Avis. Her long kangaroo face peered at him with no more emotion in her eyes than the animal she was often compared to.
Oh, there we are, from The Heaven of Mercury by Brad Watson. Carol Horn, I knew there was a reason we had you back here. In a month of Sundays or Mondays or Tuesdays, we don't get boy scat and naked cartwheels and a pelvis shaped like a smooth white plow and the slivers of view between buttonwood leaves, but there we get it all, the heaven of Mercury in just a page and a half. Gosh, we know why we come back to fiction.
We do.
This is on your list, your personal list of favorites. I guess we hear it all in the language. Is there a story as well that goes beyond all this imagery that's going to sweep us up if we dig into the Heaven of Mercury?
There is a story. It's all the different characters in the town, mostly narrated by Finus. One of the most wonderful things about the book is that anytime somebody in town dies, he does obituaries. And they are not like any obituaries you've ever heard or read. And they're really wonderful and scattered through the book. But he's in love with Bertie all his life. He winds up marrying Avis, the woman who discovered him in the bushes there. Bertie winds up marrying someone else who dies mysteriously. There's an undertaker and a subplot with that.
We are drawn in. And for all this, Brad Watson won the American Academy of Arts and Letters First Fiction Prize. And I guess we're not surprised by that. I can hear your affection for this book, Carol Horn. Ron Charles, what's up at the top of your list this year?
The top of everyone's list that I know is Atonement. It's just an incredible book. It's one of your favorites, too, right, Carol?
It's one of my favorites, too.
This is Ian McEwan's.
Right.
And of course, he was ready for his comeback. He won the 1998 Booker Prize for Amsterdam.
Right, which is a very funny, sharp book, but it's nothing like the profundity of this book.
Tell us about Atonement, Ian McEwan.
It begins with a party in a sort of Gothic house before the Second World War, and there's a young girl, 13 years old, named Bryony, and she's writing little plays, and she wants to be the center of attention, and she's intercepted a love letter between her sister's boyfriend and her sister, and she has all her own little schemes going on. She becomes convinced that her sister's boyfriend is a sex maniac. Mm-hmm. She's out to stop him. This, of course, amounts to nothing, except that one of the little boys goes missing that night. And in the panic of looking for him, she thinks that she sees a cousin being raped, and she accuses this young man.
Publicly, yes, so it turns into something serious.
Very serious, and the rest of his life is completely ruined.
He goes to prison.
And this is by the accusation of a 13-year-old girl
in the panic of the evening for looking for this little boy. Mm-hmm. And she realizes over the years that she was wrong, that it wasn't him. And she doesn't know what to do, and she spends the rest of her life trying to atone for this, and she turns to fiction to do it.
We can see just in the bones of your description how compelling this might be, but what is it precisely in Ian McEwan's handling of this story that puts it at the top of your list and many others?
He does three things really, really well. The first part of the book is a great imitation satire of other great English authors. The middle part is one of the most spectacular war novels I've read. And then the third part, I won't give away, because anything I say will spoil it. It has a very surprising ending.
Can you read something from Atonement?
Yeah, here's a paragraph early in the book talking about this young girl and her affection for fiction, which, will save her in the end.
What's the setting, Ron Charles?
They're in England. It's at her...
This is a World War II era?
Right, just before.
All right.
It's at her Gothic estate. And she's basically being ignored while the whole family sets up this enormous dinner party for the evening.
From Ian McEwan's Atonement.
At the age of 11, she wrote her first story, A foolish affair, imitative of a half dozen folk tales, and lacking, she realized later, that vital knowingness about the ways of the world which compels a reader's respect. But this first clumsy attempt showed her that the imagination itself was a source of secrets. Once she had begun a story, no one could be told. Pretending in words was too tentative, too vulnerable, too embarrassing to let anyone know. Even writing out the she-saids and thens made her wince. She felt foolish, appearing to know about the emotions of an imaginary being. Self-exposure was inevitable the moment she described a character's weakness. The reader was bound to speculate that she was describing herself. What other authority could she have? Only when a story was finished, all fates resolved and the whole matter sealed off at both ends, so it resembled, at least in this one respect, every other finished story in the world, could she feel immune and ready to punch holes in the margins, bind the chapters with pieces of string, paint or draw the cover and take the finished work to show her mother or her father when he was home.
So this one rings it for you, Atonement. And this of course, the girlish worldview of a person who will go on to spend a life considering, contemplating atonement.
Right. And the power of fiction, both the fiction to destroy this young man's life, whom she accused, and then the picture to redeem herself.
Carol Horn, let's jump right into this New York Times business. The New York Times book review said in a very self-conscious kind of way, as they introduced their editor's choice list, that after having for many years had 20 or two dozen or more books on that list, they were only pointing to 7 this year as worthy of their list. Was this a bad year for fiction somehow?
No, it wasn't.
Oh.
I don't know what was wrong at the New York Times. There were many, many reviews that seemed to me gratuitously nasty. For example, The Heaven of Mercury got a scathing review. I mean, really nasty review by Richard Eder.
Mm-hmm.
Michiko Kakutani seemed to take every second novel and talk about why it wasn't as good as The Promise of the First.
Which can be an interesting critical approach, but you could hear her stamping her feet in the background. I couldn't understand the anger about it.
No, I mean, surely this is not just the New York water this year. I mean, are the New Yorkers just so off their feed, Ron Charles? What do you think about this, the kind of negative tone?
I think we've reached a stage in which one proves how sophisticated one is by how much one can hate a book.
Well, that's not new, is it?
No, it's not new.
It seemed more pronounced this year,
yeah,
though.
Edgar Allan Poe did it.
So it's not entirely new anyway. Well, they came up with 7. We're coming up with more here. Carol Horn, give us another off your list of I Love These.
It's a collection of short stories. You talked about the astonishing number of first novelists, first story writers that
many
got
this year.
Published this year. They were really amazing. And this is a collection by Adam Hazlett called You Are Not a Stranger Here. They're fairly grim sort of stories. It's not something to read if you want something to put you in a good mood. They all have dark themes, but his writing is just astonishing.
And popular enough to make the Times bestseller list.
Yes.
So unusual for short stories. We'll come back and have a little read from that perhaps after the break. But here, this is a Yale law student, I guess, who's got his debut book out here with a collection of short stories. Yale Law School has been kind of producing some pretty well-read. Well, Stephen Carter was out with The Emperor of Ocean Park, I guess, last year.
That's right. And we were talking earlier that there are several medical students who have first novels that were quite good.
Daniel Mason.
What's he out with, Ron Charles?
The Piano Lesson.
Yes, this is the one.
Beautiful.
The Piano Tuner, isn't it? Forgive me if I'm wrong.
You're right, The Piano Tuner.
This is the one set in Burma.
Right.
Where they go out. I want to hear about both of these, but say that. But that's a first novel as
and
well.
And he's in medical school now.
Well, you know.
What is he doing? On the weekends, he's just writing these great books.
You know, medical school, it's kind of a day at the beach. Listeners, we are talking tonight about the best fiction of 2002, best books. You are welcome to join us. My guests are Carol Horn, she's from the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Ron Charles, book editor at the Christian Science Monitor. You can join us as well. What voices, what themes spoke to you in print this year? What book sent you, saved you, pulled you through? What's been the glory of your nightstand? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255.
1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about best books, best fiction, 2002 tonight. We're just about to wrap up this year. What author is speaking to you now, speaking to the moment? Are we getting what we need from contemporary literature? Who's delivering the insight, the anchor in a storm? And was 2002 a good year for new fiction? The New York Times could only find 7 books for its best of list. Is it really that bad? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Ron Charles, book editor at the Christian Science Monitor, and by Carol Horn, senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Carol Horn, we were talking before the break about Adam Haslett's You Are Not a Stranger Here. Collection of short stories did very well in sales across the country on bestseller list as a short story collection. Give us a little taste of Adam Haslett's short stories. Debut book from this young writer at Yale Law School.
Well, it's the first story in the book called Notes to My Biographer, and it's the story that got him a lot of attention when it was published in a small magazine. And it is, the narrator is a 73-year-old man who is manic depressive or bipolar or whatever we say these
All right.
days. And he has set out on a trip across the country to visit his estranged children. Two things to get straight from the beginning. I hate doctors and have never joined a support group in my life. At 73, I'm not about to change. The mental health establishment can go screw itself on a barren hilltop in the rain before I touch their snake oil or listen to the visionless chatter of men half my age. I've shot Germans in the field of Normandy, filed 26 patents, married 3 women, survived them all, and I'm currently the subject of an investigation by the IRS, which has about as much chance of collecting from me as Shylock did of getting his pound of flesh. Bureaucracies have trouble thinking clearly. I, on the other hand, am perfectly lucid.
Adam Haslett from You Are Not a Stranger Here, and this is Notes to My Biographer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a young writer speaking through the mouth of an old man in the character.
One of the amazing things about this book is the difference in all the narrators. I mean, he changes narrators, ages, sexes, and his voice changes pretty dramatically through the stories.
So he's got a great versatility there. You mentioned Ron Charles, the piano tuner, and right. Describe this story for us. It's such a kind of lush, inviting story. This is a young Englishman who goes out to Burma.
He's a married man, and he receives a note
right.
from a colonel that the queen needs his help, that there is an officer in Burma who has a piano that he uses to tame the natives. And this is of utmost importance to the queen that this man be kept satisfied. So he's to be sent. It takes a month to get there through the jungle and across Europe and then through the jungle. He's to go there, tune the piano, and come home. But I won't give too much away by saying that it's a much bigger voyage than he realizes. It's sort of a heart of darkness, but kind of a heart of whiteness.
So he follows the piano-tuning mission into the heart of political conflict in Burma,
right.
set in 1886 or so. What was it
and
about this book by Daniel Mason
it
that
grabbed
you? It is
very beautifully written. It is very lush. It's very sensitive to the piano tuner, to what he loves about music, what he loves about beauty, to what it's like to leave one's family. To go towards something that you sort of hope for but can't define. As he goes into this jungle, he loses himself.
And here we are with another debut novel, I guess, 26-year-old medical student at the University of California, San Francisco.
This is his first book. This is amazing. It's wonderful that these things spring out of nowhere like mushrooms in the morning. You just wonder, where are these people coming from?
These are the youngins. At the same time, I was reading Norman Mailer a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you saw in The New Yorker. I had a wonderful essay called Birds and Lions about writing and the life of writing and American letters. He said, as an old letter, and this comes to mind listening to you read from first-time writers, very young, he said, in the course of fashioning a character, you invariably reach a point where you recognize that you don't know enough about the person you're trying to create. At such times, I take it for granted that my unconscious knows more than I do. As you go through life, you do, after all, observe everyone wittingly and unwittingly. Out of the corner of your eye, you glimpse someone in a restaurant who represents a particular menace or possibility, potentially a friend or a foe, and the unconscious goes to work on that. It needs very little evidence to put together a comprehensive portrait because, presumably, it has already done most of the labor. Well, fair enough if you're Norman Mailer, the great age and sage, but when you're 25 and 26, well, maybe the mind is just that amazing, Carol Horn, that it fills in all the blanks, whether it's in imagining the mind of a man, you know, five times your age, or imagining 1886 Burma.
Well, and looking at the books that were on my top 10 list, any number of them were set in century before last now,
mm-hmm.
Or early in the last century. You know, there's obviously some research that goes in, but an immense amount of imagination to really bring that world to life.
It's fun to see what that young imagination comes up with. We're talking about best books, best fiction, 2002. What voices, what themes spoke to you in this past year? What book just sent you, saved you, pulled you through? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Lauren's on the line. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to recommend A Lecturer's Tale by Charles Hines, and I'm not sure whether it came out this past year or the year before, but it was just side-splittingly funny. It's an academic satire and very modern, and I wanted to add a complaint to that, which is that I don't find very many funny books at all, and I find the world so rough that I just want books that are funny, and if you go into a bookstore and ask for a book that's funny, you'll get a book that may have some, you know, some kind of very sad humor in it, but there's all sorts of horrible things happening.
But not really a thigh slapper. You're recommending James Hines' The Lecturer's Tale, A Lecturer's Tale?
I'm not sure if it's A Lecturer's Tale or The Lecturer's Tale, but it's Charles Hines, I think.
Okay,
Your book critics could probably say, but...
They may know. Charles Hines, Lecturer's Tale, gave you a good laugh, and you raise a really interesting point, Lauren, about humor and fiction these days. Ron Charles, it doesn't seem to be kind of the marquee theme or continent of fiction, but do we misread? Lauren's looking for a few more laughs out there in tough times.
There were some funny books this year, which I really enjoyed. The funniest...
What would you recommend for Lauren along those lines?
Tupper Isn't Going Out by Calvin Trillin. It's very funny. Nothing bad happens there. It's about a man named Murray Tupper who just wants to park in New York. And he goes, and he finds a good spot, and he stays there all day, and he brings the city to a halt because he won't leave his parking spot. He won't cooperate. It's very, very charming.
And he found his parking space and hunkers down there,
and
the world be damned will revolve around him.
Just wants to read the paper there.
Okay, so there's a laugh.
And it's not a first novel by any means.
No, not from Calvin Trillin.
A very mature writer who's still writing with a wonderfully deft touch. A very, very silly book that I hate to bring up because it makes me look very unsophisticated, called The Air Affair by Jasper Ford. It's a satire, science fiction, very comic. It's a world in which novels are real places, and crooks break into novels and steal characters out of them. And if you ever had to suffer through Jane Eyre, this is your revenge. It's loopy and crazy, but very clever.
So there's some humor. And as for Lauren's recommendation, it's The Lecturer's Tale by James Hines, published in February this year, soon to be last year. James Hines has written several other books along this line of academic themes and humor, including Publish and Perish, Three Tales of Tenure and Terror. You know the book, Ron
that
Charles?
Is funny.
Yeah, there you go. There's for a laugh. Carol Horn, keep us going here. What else is on your list? What's populating your best of list?
Well, as I look here, I think Lauren is onto something. There are not a lot of funny books on my list,
mm-hmm.
although The Little Friend by Donna Tartt has some hilarious parts to it.
The Little Friend, this is the one set in Mississippi.
Mississippi.
A girl, wise beyond her years.
Wise beyond her years, who decides, I think she's 12, and she decides to solve the 10-year-old, no, it must be the 12-year-old murder of her brother. So it starts out with this murder of a child, which mm-hmm. seems to be something of a theme this year. But her investigation, if you will, with her best friend and sidekick, gets into some amazingly funny and scary tense sort of things.
Can you tease us a little more with what makes it scary? Because I've heard this book described. I haven't come to it yet. But what is it? What does it unbuckle that ends up being so scary and, I guess, profound?
Well, she decides,
without giving it away, but take us a little closer, can you?
Okay. This is hard.
Okay, here's brain surgery.
She decides that she knows who the murderer is, and mm-hmm. it's a boy who was a classmate of her brother's, who is now, well, in Mississippi, they would be called white trash, poor white trash.
Mm.
Lives in a trailer with his brother, who's running a methamphetamine lab, is involved with religious fanatics who are snake handlers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where they are caught in a building with this room full of snakes that is both hilarious and also just terrifying. And the sort of scrapes that she gets into as she chases this guy who she's convinced killed her brother.
Well, you've got me hooked, and I've got a couple of snake handlers in the family history, so we can relate to that. Can you give us a little reading from The Little Friend by Donna Tartt?
Yeah.
This is, we waited a long time for this, right? She had the very, very successful The Secret History about 10 years ago.
10 years ago, and everybody was wondering whether she was one of those, you know, one great novel writers, but I think she's at least a two great novel writer.
And she's back in her native Mississippi. Give us just a taste of The Little Friend from Donna Tartt.
Okay, this is the introduction of Harriet, the little girl who goes on to try to solve the crime. Harriet the baby was neither pretty nor sweet. Harriet was smart. From the time she was old enough to talk, Harriet had been a slightly distressing presence in the Cleve household. Fierce on the playground, rude to company, she argued with Edie, that's her grandmother, and checked out library books about Genghis Khan and gave her mother headaches. She was 12 years old and in the 7th grade. Though she was an A student, the teachers had never known how to handle her. Sometimes they telephoned her mother, or Edie, who, as anyone who knew anything about the Cleves was aware, was the one you wanted to talk to. She was both field marshal and autocrat, the person of greatest power in the family, and the person most likely to act. But Edie herself was uncertain how to deal with Harriet. Harriet was not disobedient exactly, or unruly, but she was haughty, and somehow managed to irritate nearly every adult with whom she came in contact.
And there you are, from Donna Tartt's The Little Friend. Watch out for 12-year-old girls reading books on Genghis Khan. They will be powers. Ron Charles, you have on your list, if I'm not wrong, another book of the South, Southish, Enemy Women by Paulette Giles.
Oh, yeah.
Is that not – this is the one set in Missouri during the Civil War.
Right.
Give us a sense of this.
It was a part of history I didn't know much about, even though I'm from St. Louis, and that is the way the Union – terrorized families along the border between the South and the North.
Bloody, vicious time, especially in Missouri.
Yeah, trying to create a system of terror so that the rebels wouldn't have any place to hide.
The Mason-Dixon line would not creep.
Right, and one of the ways they did this was by capturing women and imprisoning them in St. Louis and other in places even further north.
So in Paulette Giles' Enemy Women, and by the way, isn't she a poet first and foremost?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But here she's
this is her debut novel.
A poet's debut novel.
And so it skirts along the border during the war with this horrendous tragedy of this 18-year-old woman, a Missouri farm girl who loses everything. And she has no slave. She has no interest in the Civil War in any way. She really is, like so many of these people, an innocent bystander. And Giles follows her to the St. Louis prison and to what she endures. And it's very compelling.
As a historical novel? What
yes,
themes does it
strum? As a historical novel.
Mm-hmm.
There was another good historical novel about the Civil War, which takes a sort of new approach. And that is, not a new approach, but a new facet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, the one set in New York?
Oh, the one about the riots.
Yeah. What is that? Paradise Alley.
Paradise Alley.
Paradise Alley. Oh, yeah. This is Kevin Baker's.
Yeah, that's an explosive book. Lincoln said that he wanted that you could buy your way out of the draft for $300.
Right.
And for the Irish immigrants who'd just gotten here, who didn't have any interest
in the Civil War. There was no $300 left.
And they didn't have $300.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no interest in fighting in the Civil War.
No.
And so you had
one
of the most explosive riots in American history, but one that's very little discussed or remembered.
They just about destroyed the island. Apparently they burned half of it down.
Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want to go to Shiloh or wherever else the Union armies were fighting.
Right.
Let's turn to a call. Venkut is on the line. Welcome, Venkut. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to talk about Rohinton Mistry's novel Family Matters, which was one of the Booker nominees this year. And it was a novel that I was really rooting for. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Mistry's and have been since the time he published his novel of Fine Balance. I'm a big fan of his unpretentious style of writing. And I believe that he is in the same league as Salman Rushdie. Mm. And I want to know what your guests today think about this book.
Great. That's great. And I know that Family Matters, Rohinton Mistry's book, is, I believe, Carol, on your list of top picks for the year.
It was on my list.
This is the second book, as Venkut points out, by an Indian author, but based in Canada. First book, A Fine Balance, was picked by Oprah. We'll talk about how Oprah's left this world. but was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 96, and now Family Matters, also a near winner of the prize.
Yeah, it's a really amazing book. There's not a lot of plot to it. It's essentially a group of Parsis in Bombay.
All right.
And the aging patriarch has Parkinson's and finally gets moved to one of the daughters. And it's really about, you know, family matters, as the title says, how they deal with this illness, how... I mean, he suggests that the only way that any of us can learn to deal with death and dying is by dealing with it when our parents die. But, you know, there's squabbling, there's all kinds of family stuff. And his language and the way he captures the conversations is, I think the comparison to Rushdie is quite accurate.
Is this, another great name in the kind of Indian juggernaut of the last 10 years and more?
I think so. I think A Fine Balance was one of the really wonderful novels of a few years ago. And I think he's young and will write a lot more.
And Venkut, what did you take away from Family Matters?
Well, I thought as someone who has lived in India and seen both the pettiness that can arise out of poverty and also how uplifting adversity can be, I thought it was a pretty accurate portrayal, both by way of its details and by, the profound nature of its message.
And what do you think about the experience of Rohinton Mistry writing from afar? Does that make it easier to write in such detail about Bombay, the distance of being half a world away? Can you feel that distance as you read the book, Venkut?
Well, I believe he's an author who has lived for a large portion of his life in Bombay. So
he carries it with him.
I think he does have a bird's eye view of the whole thing. Mm.
Venkut, thanks so much for your call. Ron Charles, are you keeping track of the Indian juggernaut out there? Are any of these this great crew on your list this year?
I didn't read that book. I wanted to by the time I heard about the nomination, but mm-hmm. I'm
couple of books to read out there.
Pushed forward rather than back.
right. We are talking this hour about best books of 2002, best fiction, that is. You're welcome to join the conversation. What do you want from a new book now? What facet of life do you need to have explored or illuminated? And how much do you count on fiction writers to help you make sense of this world, to keep the heart fresh? You can join the conversation tonight with Carol Horn, senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore, and Ron Charles, book editor at the Christian Science Monitor. We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Best Fiction 2002. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Best Fiction 2002 tonight. What's your best book nominee for this year before the year ends? What book thrilled you? I guess, what let you down? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Carol Horn. She's vice president and senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore, an independent bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Ron Charles, book editor at the Christian Science Monitor. You are welcome to join us as well. Lydia's on the line. Hi, Lydia. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had a book I wanted to plug, and I had some thoughts about the New York Times.
Ooh, good. Go for both.
Okay. I wanted to plug Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated. I think
yes.
It got a little lost in the shuffle because it came out pretty early in the year.
Yeah, it didn't get lost here. We had him on. It was a wonderful book. He was wonderful to talk to. What captured you about it, Lydia?
Well, It put me off at first because its language is in this bad English that I found a little cutesy at first, mm-hmm. and then once I got into it, it was hilarious, and then got me crying buckets at the end by something that seemed to me a sort of anti-sentimental approach, which I really appreciated.
Now, this is the young man who goes back in the company of a Russian or Ukrainian guide to visit the shtetl of his Jewish
right.
forebears in the Ukraine.
Yes.
And then learns the story of the whole kind of Holocaust unraveling of their lives.
Right, and goes back in a kind of mythic way to what the family story was, and mm-hmm. then tries to tie both the Holocaust and life, you know, now after the Holocaust, into what life is really like.
And there's nothing like unraveling family stories for revealing all kinds of tender points. And I'll never forget that image of the wagon going off the bridge into the river, I guess the kind of peddler's wagon, and all the items sort of bubbling up through the dark water there. Very, very cinematic image. Thanks for mentioning the book. We love talking with Jonathan Safran Foer on the show a few months ago. Your thoughts on the New York Times Book Review 7-book list. All they could muster enthusiasm for was 7 books.
I think you'd have to be insane to say that there were only 7 notable books this year. This was an excellent year for books, and obviously everybody thought it was an excellent year for first novelists. And what strikes me is that it wasn't the reviewers, I don't think, that kept it down to 7 books. I think all of the reviewers mentioned what a great year it was for first novels and things. And I think there must be some inherent editorial, I don't know who makes these decisions exactly, but something in it has an extreme bias towards Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, and John Updike. And they keep appearing every year. They have something out. It's right there.
Yeah.
And I don't think they've adjusted to a generation past that.
Oh, well, you're whacking that tight-fisted crew, Lydia. Thanks for calling in with that. That's terrific. Daniel's on the line. Welcome, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Well, thanks.
I just want to recommend an excellent sort of a science fiction novel called The Years of Rice and Salt by Kim Stanley Robinson. It was a Nobel book of the year for the New York Times.
Tell us about it. The Years of Rice and Salt.
Yeah, it's an alternate history novel, and Robinson sort of goes out of his way to fight against the cliche that all science fiction is bad writing. And this follows it's a sketch of the world as if the Black Plague had wiped out all of Europe, and China and Islam
had filled the vacuum.
Wow.
And
it avoids the it's incredibly well researched and beautifully written.
What
and,
a great year for such a book to be out there.
I actually found it very, very moving. It's not the standard action adventure kind of stuff that you usually see, and especially for any kind of alternate history, it's usually a very tacky sort of genre, and you usually see things like, you know, what if Robert E. Lee, you know, drove a DeLorean.
Right.
Kind of
joke. It's not too late.
It's really beautifully written.
Daniel, you give us a good tip. The Years of Rice and Salt, science fiction. But not so unimaginable from Kim Stanley Robinson. Thanks so much for your call. Ron, Carol, I guess I want to ask you about the shadow of 9/11 on this year. Now, we all know that publishing works in long cycles.
And, not in 9/11's case.
Well, speak about that, because I know a bunch of books came out about 9/11 itself. I wonder, though, if 9/11 is yet showing itself in literature as opposed to coffee table books or is it yet showing up in the kind of deep filtering that literature will one day have its way, I guess?
We counted more than 300 books directly related to 9/11. Some of them came out within 2 weeks. The technology has adjusted so that books can respond in a way that in the past only newspapers could.
So what's the treatment? Are we talking about the true story, the heartrending story of the survivors, the victims? How's it being treated? Is it making its way into serious fiction yet?
I haven't seen it yet.
Not yet.
So these are kind of remembering the event books.
Or describing them as they happened and then racing to the printer.
And the impact of that, Carol, on the publishing world this year?
Well, certainly around the first anniversary. I think it was the first anniversary when there were over 300 books. It just sort of sucked up all the available energy and
marketing bandwidth, I suppose. Or?
Marketing, reviewing, discussion. I mean, every bookstore, I think, felt compelled to have some sort of display. We did.
Did they sell? Did people want to read about 9/11 a year after?
Some of the more serious books, you know, the analyses of, you know, East versus West, what went wrong. Certainly in our store, some of the more politically left books, Noam Chomsky's 9/11 has continues to be on our bestseller list and has been since it came out, which was fairly soon after the event. But in general, no, they didn't sell.
And it will be interesting to look forward to the time when that shadow shows up in serious fiction, Ron Charles. Is there anything coming that you know of?
There was a collection, remember, called New York
Oh, yeah,
Writers.
Short stories collection.
We reviewed that. I didn't do it myself, but they were all fairly well done. They were by very, very fine writers. Mm.
But not all fiction. I mean, some of it was essays and, and reminiscences and personal reflections.
Where I was.
But there were a few stories. Mm.
But not such a big footprint yet in the world of fiction. Ron, take us on into your list and give us a quick nutshell of a few more of your favorites from 2002.
Gould's Book of Fish. It is the slipperiest, wackiest book of the year. And he got to publish, this is Richard Flanagan's third book, Gould's Book of Fish.
The Tasmanian author, no?
Yes, he is spectacular, I think. In this book, the narrator finds a book called The Book of Fish, and as he reads it, the spots from the book travel up his arm, and as he turns the pages, each page dissolves into water, and he becomes a fish. And what he's reading about is this remarkable story of a prisoner sent to the penal colony in Tasmania, which I guess was the worst penal colony ever conceived. And this man is kept in a cage on the shore so that every time the tide comes in, he's drowned.
So this was William Gould of Gould's Book of Fish, a kind of 19th century convict in the Tasmanian gulag.
He's writing his book with spines he gets from fish bones and things like that.
So this is surrealism? This
is
often surreal history?
The publisher cooperated by printing the chapters in different colors with the different body fluids he had to use to write the book.
Give us another.
Caramello by Sandro Cisneros. It's been 18 years since The House on Mango Street. And this is nothing like that book, but it's a beautiful, wildly complicated book. Three generations told in multiple voices, Americans and Mexicans. Very, very fine.
Caramello by Sandra Cisneros, about Mexican-Americans and Mexicans and Americans. Carol, give us a couple more.
The Life of Pi, I think you mentioned earlier, by Yann Martell.
Yes.
Is
Won the Booker Prize.
Quite an amazing book. Won the Booker Prize. I think
this is the Ben Goldtiger and the boy in the lifeboat.
Right. The family is leaving and on a ship with this zoo, and he winds up with a Bengal tiger who eats everything but him. The Bengal tiger's name is Richard Parker. It's both kind of allegory, magical, realistic fable, but it also reads sort of like an adventure story. There's a lot about how you survive on a raft and, you know, animal zoology and
fringe of controversy, because there was a work in Portuguese by a Brazilian author from some years ago, Max and the Cats, that was similar. But all right, that's there. But what's the theme? What's the moral of The Life of Pi, the boy and the tiger?
Well, I think it's really you know, a look at faith and science. And this boy is of three religions, but is also very interested in zoology and animals and how that plays out. But it's also just a great adventure story.
Well, there you go. The Life of Pi by Yann, Yann Martell. And with that, we're out of time. We haven't even gotten halfway down your list. They're good, rich lists, and we'll have to do it again, but I thank you so much for coming in, and it's been great to have you run through your favorite fiction, 2002. Carol Horn, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Carol Horn is vice president and senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore, an independent bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Ron Charles, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Ron Charles is book editor at the Christian Science Monitor. You can continue the book conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, reflections on freedom from a man exonerated by DNA evidence after 20 years in prison. This is On Point. Last month, Bernard Webster became the 115th inmate nationwide to be exonerated by the admission of DNA evidence. In 1983, Webster was sentenced to 30 years in a Maryland prison for a rape he didn't commit. He was 19. 20 years later, a judge ordered him released, telling Webster that justice moves slow at times, and in your case, it moved very, very slow. Bernard Webster has been out of prison for a month and a half now. In this radio diary, he reflects on his new life as a free man.
I was pretty much, like, really, like, relieved, right, that this was all over with. Yeah, the only thing, you know, most of my, I had to leave my friends in there. When I first got there, I was a teenager, and I had to grow up very quickly. By the time I was, like, 25 years old, I knew a great deal about life in general. But as you grow and you get older and you get smarter, you get wiser, things start to come easy. You can go anywhere you want to go, anytime you want to go. I mean, you don't have to report nowhere. I mean, you don't have to ask somebody, can you go? I went to my brother's house and asked him, could I use his bathroom? And he got on me so hard. And he said, don't you ever ask me, can you use a bathroom in here? Just go. Bathroom right there. I was lucky to even just be able to get out of prison without coming out in a bag or dying in prison of some disease. You know, I've seen many people die in prison of disease because they get poor medical attention. You know, I could have got killed, it's possible. Or I could have killed somebody and never got out anyway. So, you know, you have to look at all that. You have to look at your whole situation. Right now, I consider myself lucky. At the time that I was convicted, I considered myself unlucky. And to have to spend 20 years in prison, that was an unlucky task I had to do. But when you're in there and it's hard for you to get out, and you trying to get out, and you constantly trying to get out, but they, you know, things are not turning the right corners for you, right? You still got to live your life. I don't care what goes on. You know, I believed I could have been anything I wanted to be if I just applied the tools. But you have to look at the bitter part of it, too. I spent 20 years in prison. I stayed out there in the street doing things I don't have no business doing. I might not be here to tell you this. You know, you have to look at the both parts of it. You just can't look at the good part when you think that, you know, I mean, like I could have been anything I wanted to be, right? But I also could have been dead. The people of Baltimore, all the churches and all the organizations and just everybody have really, really, like, helped me get, a fresh start on life. You know, everybody's lending their support, and everybody, you know, they're still lending their support. The lawyers that got me out support me. I mean, we're almost like best friends. But it's just something, it's special, you know what I mean?
Bernard Webster lives in Baltimore, Maryland. He was released from prison in early November. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is W.